You will have so many things that will open up to you as vistas to enrich your lives, to deepen them. And I'd like to share with you this evening a deep, deep, deep love of mine. It's part of me I never really get to speak about or share, but this has allowed me to do it. I never worked so hard for one specific lecture in my life. The thought of distilling, I had so many projects in mind. One is distilling from thousands of works that which would be most accessible at the outset to you, because I hope to open a window for those of you who do not now love classical music. That will be a lifetime gift. I know in advance that for some people it won't work. I say that with terrible pain. I say it with the pain of the true believer who wants to proselytize and can't understand why others won't accept what he is so sure of. But life is chastening and sobering, and I recognize that some, it will simply not respond. Some people will not respond. I ask you to give it a try, because as sure as I am that some may not respond, I am certain that some of you will never forget this evening, because it will have opened up what was either unknown or just so vague and difficult. What's the difference between Bach and Beethoven, a symphony and a concerto, and who's Mozart? And those of you who laugh know that it's Mozart, not Mozart. That's all right. I prefer you listen to Mozart than know how to pronounce Mozart. I prefer that you know how to pronounce and listen. Let me give you some guidelines, talk to you a little about the nature of music and why I think it's so sublime and so enriching. First, the guidelines. Really do note this down if you have pen and paper, because you'll forget it by the 28th piece of music I'm going to play for you tonight. Listen to a piece three times before you never listen again. You've got to give it three chances minimum. Please understand that you do not listen to classical music the way you listen to movie music, the way you listen to pop music. They all have their place, but this is not the same thing. It is, you have to listen with your brain, not with your ear. Your brain can be disconnected when you listen to pop music. The beat is clear, the melody is clear, your brain doesn't have to work. And I'm not saying that as an insult, I'm saying it as a fact. Why do I call this deep? This is because this art touches everything. Your soul, your brain, your spirit, your ear, your emotions. You'll know it's working if sometime you will have the chills, or you will feel a moment of religious fervor, or you'll want to cry, or whatever it will induce. It's supposed to induce feeling. That's what it's about. That's part of the problem of much 20th century music, which was written by academics for academics. Nobody got touched by it. That's why you never hear of that stuff, and it'll never be played again except by those who pursue Trivial Pursuit, the music edition. Music is meant to touch, and it does, and I'm going to show you all the areas that I could think of in which it does it. I'll explain the way I've worked out the evening. Here is a tip now on how not to get distracted. For a neophyte, a novice in classical music, that's the biggest problem. Your mind is going to start wandering immediately to how much gas is in your car. Okay? Beethoven writes his heart out, and you're wondering how you park your car. This is a problem, and I appreciate that. So I have some suggestions. One is, listen for all the instruments. Remember, don't listen like you listen. You listen to melody and pop music, and you don't have to make an effort. It's effortless, right? Jingle bell, jingle bell, jingle all the way, ra-ta-ta-da-dee-dee-dee, is really pretty basic, and it captures your attention because it hits the melodious part of your makeup, right? It's a melody. You can walk away singing it. Most people don't leave Prokofiev's Sixth Symphony humming it, okay? It's not hummable, for one thing. Some of it is hummable, but that's not the criterion you should use. Hummable doesn't make it great. Hummable makes it hummable. So here's a trick. Don't think in that way. Think, if you're starting to get your attention diverted, think about, hey, that's an oboe. Isn't that interesting? Look at what he's doing with the oboe. Or don't listen to the most obvious melodic line, which is frequently in the violins. Start to try to hear, hey, what are the cellos doing right now? Make it a game. Make it a project. What are the other instruments than the most obvious ones doing right now? The odds are they're doing something very interesting, like playing another melody, or giving you some very interesting other idea that he wants to offer to you. Another thing, think to yourself, what emotion is the composer trying to offer now? Be happy? Sad? Both? Bittersweet? Is he talking about life or death? Is he making a great statement? Is the guy a total bore? There is boring music, no question. You can hear it if you tune on classical radio stations, especially during the day. Very frequently they will play some unknown stuff, which is unknown because it deserves to be unknown. Some unknown doesn't deserve, but a lot does. That's okay. I like the unknowns too because I'm just terribly interested in music. I ask you, though, not to let your mind wander. If it does, don't kill yourself. And don't say, wow, the piece must not be for me. My mind wandered. Folks, I could practically hum Brahms' Second Symphony to you if I had a score. And my mind will wander every so often. I bet you the conductor's mind every so often wanders. And I know for a fact the third violinist and the second violinist section's mind is wandering every so often while playing it. That happens. Don't worry about that. That doesn't mean the piece isn't great. If you will find ever that you've gotten 100% attention into a piece, it means you know it. And the more you know a great piece of music, the more you will love it. It's the opposite of Jingle Bells. See, that's the point. After the 100th time of Jingle Bells, you want to punch someone. You actually would request deafness. After the 100th time of a great work of music, you are just beginning to really get out of it what was put into it. That's the difference. And remember, rule number one of depth was, it takes effort. There is nothing deep on earth that comes the first time that isn't effortful. And this is an example. I'm offering you a present, a gift. It's worth pursuing. Let's say you give it a try. I gave ballet a try for a year. I didn't like it. I have to tell you, I watched the orchestra pit. That's what I ended up doing, which is a stupid reason to go to a ballet, right? That's how much ear-oriented I am rather than sight-oriented. So I appreciate that, but I gave it a year's try. I actually got, when I was in my teens, I got a subscription to the New York City Ballet. It just didn't work with me. This may not work with you, but give it time. It may, and then you have something that has been my companion ever since I was 14 years old. 14 or 15. It happened very beautifully, actually. It was love at first hearing. There were seats offered at Carnegie Hall for Handel Concerti Grossi. And they were a dollar. A dollar. And the entire point was to get people who can't afford tickets, like high school kids, to go. I figured for a buck, what could I lose? Some people say this stuff is great. And I was mesmerized. By the way, it wasn't that I was mesmerized by the melodies. The Handel Concerti Grossi aren't things you walk away humming either. The sound fascinated me. I felt then, as I feel today, that the composer is talking to me. I approach it as you would approach a great novel. What is the novelist trying to say? And that's all I think of. What is the composer trying to say? And I will show you examples that will blow your mind. Things that you never would have imagined, even some of you music mavens. I strongly suspect I'll have a surprise or two for you, especially the very last piece of the evening, which should cause at least two or three suicides. You'll understand why at the time. But we have a clinic here which will look into it. Now, another thing. I told you to listen to the instruments. Just ask, what are they doing? Don't listen like jingle. Don't listen for melody. That'll come naturally. You listen for what's going on. You get it? What's, like, if you were looking at a complex painting, what's happening in the left corner? What's happening in the right corner? What's happening in the middle? What's this color? Think of it like that. What's going on? The melody will get to you. That just is natural. Try to pick out a theme and see what happens to the theme. Usually the composer is going to do something with it. In fact, the very best example of that I heard years ago, done by P.D.Q. Bach, an extremely funny musical satirist. Those of you who at all know New York City will realize how funny he is. He once wrote a concerto for Horn and Hardart. Horn and Hardart was the name of a cafeteria in New York. But anyway, what he did once was he did Beethoven's Fifth as if he were a baseball announcer. And they're stepping up. There come the violins. And they're starting out with a theme. My God, it is a four-note theme. That is all he had in his repertoire, was a four-note theme. Where's it going? It's going to the cellos. Oh, my God, it's a pass to the cellos. And if you think like that, it's the easiest is to do in Beethoven's Fifth First Movement. That's the whole thing, is da-da-da-da. That is Beethoven's genius, that he could do da-da-da-da and send you skying over, levitating over your chair with two notes, a G and an E flat. I mean, that's not bad. Not bad. If you gave me a G and an E flat, I could put you to sleep instantaneously. That's why he's Beethoven and I'm an ethical monotheist. That's the way it goes. The next thing to do in all of these things is see what it does to your mood. Does it affect you? Is it getting in there and digging in? It might. Some may not. There's a lot of classical music I don't respond to. Debussy is a giant, but I fall asleep within 3 minutes of Debussy. And outside of one or two pieces by Ravel, I'm just the French Impressionists do zilch for me. Okay? I tend not to get into much opera. Opera's great. It is. The voice doesn't touch me as it touches some people who go crazy. Choral music does. En masse, I love voices. So please understand, you may not like every selection tonight, though I really did handpick stuff that I can't imagine just about everybody at least having a sense of access to. I'll talk to you at the very end about equipment and starting out on that stuff, but now let's get into the music. Let me just explain how we're going to work it. There are six periods of music to be that we're really concerned with in Western music. They are Baroque, Rococo, Classical, Romantic, Post-Romantic, and 20th century. Though a lot of 20th century is post-romantic, a lot of 20th century is what we would just call modern music, if you will. The dates are, of course, approximate, and they overlap. And, of course, composers overlap them all the time. The Baroque is the longest. It's about 1600 to 1720. That includes such giants as Bach, Handel, and Vivaldi. Rococo is 1728. This is all approximate. to the year of the American Revolution, 1776 or so. That includes, and I'm only picking some giant names, Joseph Haydn, the father of the symphony. That's why he's called Papa Haydn. The classical period goes from about 1775 to 1820, and it includes Mozart, Beethoven, Schubert, and, though not dates of his life, but dates of his music, Rossini. Also, please note that Beethoven stretches into the Romantic, which goes from 1825 to 1880, and you get Robert Schumann, Antonin Dvorak, Peter Tchaikovsky, names that will be Felix Mendelssohn, names that are, of course, familiar to everyone in Western life. Then you have post-Romantic, where you would have, and the 20th century, where you will have names that may be less known to you, but Sibelius would be a good example, the great Finnish composer of post-Romantic. Anyway, we'll come to that when we come to it. This is the way I've structured the evening. I'm sorry? Dates of what? I'm sorry? Post-Romantic? Oh, sorry. 1890 to whenever, because post-Romantic music's still being written. I've structured it as follows. In each case, I've dropped Rococo. I've thrown Haydn into classical, otherwise we'll go crazy. In each case, I have the following, or at least some of the following. An example of pure beauty. An example of reaching to the heavens. An example of joy. Just happy to be alive, and life is okay. There's not much of that. There is. It exists. Then, passion. And in three of the four cases, I'm doing Baroque, classical, romantic, and 20th century. In three of the four cases, I'm also going to do a piece that involves death. Usually the composer's own. Many composers composed till they died. Tchaikovsky composed his last symphony the month before he died, and it sounds it. The last movement sounds it. You'll understand that when we get to it. But the question is, how do you deal with death in 1820 as opposed to 1890, as opposed to 1930? How do different eras talk about beauty? And not just eras, they're all individuals. My way of expressing passion and pain may be very different from the way another composer expresses passion and pain. That's why it's wonderful. But what unifies them is that they're all human beings, very flawed human beings. But they express these things in their music, and that is the incredible nature of it, that somebody growing up today in northwestern Japan can be brought to tears by Brahms, as well as this Jewish boy from Brooklyn, and that was written by a German 100 years ago. That can't be said for Jingle Bells, with all respect to lovely melodies that I hum to. Okay, we will begin with the Baroque period, and Bach enthusiasts, don't shoot me for what I chose. I'm sure that there will be passions here I will have to leave under armed guard. But what I decided for sheer beauty, do you have the Bach in there? Is it in there? Okay, go to track 11 to 3 minutes, just to track 11. This is Bach's Concerto for Oboe and Violin, the slow movement. Just press 11. No, just 11, starting at 11. Back in a moment. Can you hear back there? Why don't you make it louder? What's the difference? Violin coming over the oboe. It's just exquisite. What is it up to? 378? Okay, you can turn it off. Now, that's a good example. Yeah, give us... fine. Put in the next one in fire. It's a good example of beauty. By the way, there is a suggestion I wish to make to you. It's something I always do. Is close your eyes while listening to music. The eye is an utterly distracted sensory organ. I, even when I go to concerts, I close my eyes. I go to concert for the sound, because you can never duplicate live, although they're coming a little closer. But I do ask you to close your eyes, because if you keep them open, you'll look at something. Somebody, a worm, a fly, whatever it'll be. So close your eyes. And did you notice the simplicity there? A violin, an oboe, and strings. Concerto is a piece of music for an orchestra and a solo instrument. Symphonies don't have solo instruments. Sometimes they do, but I don't want to drive you crazy. Symphonies are for the whole orchestra. Concertos, usually three movements. Symphonies, usually four. Concertos are almost always fast, slow, fast in their movements. And they have solo instruments. That was one for violin, oboe, and, of course, the orchestra. That was Baroque, just beauty. I don't think it had a message. It was just, here, my friends, from Bach to you, is something beautiful. We go to another Baroque, Handel. Handel is best known for the Messiah, for good reason. It is probably the most inspiring piece of religious music ever written in the world. And here is an example of what I call reaching for the heavens. I have reaching for the heavens in every single section except modern. I could find no reaching for the heavens in modern music, and that's part of my argument that with the breakdown of religion, reaching for the heavens seems to have, at least for the meantime, gone into abeyance. Anyway, you listen to, on the 11th, index here. This is the Hallelujah Chorus from Handel's Messiah. Tell me you don't get a little religious from this. Did I get to you? Yeah. Now, a lot of people don't associate the Baroque period with passion and intensity. They, especially Vivaldi, who's often dismissed as a guy who wrote one melody with 500 concertos attached to it. He did write 500 concertos. Antonio Vivaldi was a Catholic priest at a girls' orphanage. And every Sunday they had a new concert, and he would write a concerto for every Sunday. And if the orphanage brought in a cellist, he wrote a cello concerto. If that week another cellist came, he wrote a concerto for two cellos. If three, for three cellos. Three cellos and two piccolos, three cellos and two piccolos. Whoever showed up got a concerto. Now, there is some repetition. Yeah, like the, what could the guy do? Is every week. What if he was in a bad mood one week, right? You got to have, you know, a little, as they say, Rachmanis, a little pity for Father Vivaldi. But he did write a piece called The Four Seasons. That is the single most popular piece of classical music made. If number of recordings of something is indicative, and it is, this is the single most recorded piece of classical music. He wrote a concerto for each of the seasons. There are four different concertos, slow, fast, slow, fast. And they start off with the spring. Now, here is going to be for 1 minute and 36 seconds from index one, from the beginning of spring, just to give you an idea of joy, and don't forget to listen for the birds. You to hear what Vivaldi does, this Baroque melody zinger, slinger, what he can do with passion and intensity. As we go to the summer and the first movement, index seven. Okay, get going. Yeah, sorry. Oh, my mistake. That's autumn. Four. That's not tension, folks. I knew something was wrong. Give me four. That was autumn. Here we go. Now listen to one more from Winter, the beginning of Winter. To turn it off, huh? That's Vivaldi, who they accuse of writing just simple melodies. That, if I told anybody the date, didn't know music, they'd go, wow, that is intense stuff. And it is intense stuff. What I want to show you is that the 20th century produced beauty and that the Baroque period produced passion, contrary to what a lot of people might associate. Now, the question, who is the greatest composer who ever lived, is probably foolish, but I will still answer it. In my opinion, and not a few others, it's Mozart. What Mozart did, and certainly the close second would have to be Beethoven, but what Mozart did is write the purest music of all. When I tried to identify Mozart for you this evening, I realized nothing would work, because every single thing is in every piece he writes. Beauty, tension, passion. There's no way. It's what's called sui generis. Its own generic entity is Mozart. His is the purest music. It was not meant to make statements about nature. It was not meant to make statements about life and death. It was just to make the purest music possible from this genius of a mind and soul for music. I went crazy trying to decide what Mozart to pick because it's so absurd. It is like asking me what snowflake on Mount Everest to choose. It's not choosable. So I just picked one of the 200 I'm in love with. And I decided that perhaps his greatest genius is to be found in his piano concertos. And he wrote 27 of them. Certainly from number 9 on, they are monumental. And from 20 on, there is nothing like it in music. Mozart lived from 1756 to 1791, 34 years. Mozart lived 10 more years. It is not even imaginable. It's just not imaginable what he would have achieved. He was at heights that are just musically untouchable. Here is an example of just what I call beauty from the classical period of music. It's my desert island period. If I could only go with one period of music to a desert island, it's the classical. It's his 22nd piano concerto, the first 2 minutes of the third movement. So that would be on that disc. Yeah, index number 3. Close your eyes. Thank you. Pretty exquisite, huh? One of the things about Mozart is the isolation and exposure of his notes. Did you hear how crystal? They're like pearls, his notes. You hear single notes, and they soar above everything else. It's unique. You can't mistake Mozart when you know Mozart, and it is truly a gift of God. There is no other way to explain him. And I watched you, and I had a sense that that might have been truly a favorite. It gets you so immediately. Let me just give you one more example from his next piano concerto. It'll be band 4, the first 55 seconds of his piano concerto number 23. Those exposed notes above everything. Sorry, it's very difficult to shut Mozart off. Good, I want you to protest. I like that.
Is that a piano concerto?
Yes, that was piano concerto number 23. By the way, one of the good things about this is it finally forced me to publish a list of recommended works, and I'm going to publish it in the next issue of Ultimate Issues, including the versions that I used, which are also exquisite. Who does these things is very important. Bad performances or boring performances can ruin the greatest works. I can't go through the classical period without my beloved Haydn. One of my dreams in life musically is to be able to identify all 104 symphonies. If I live till 260, I have a chance. But I tell you, he's not Mozart. But so what? It's like saying that nobody should have painted after Rembrandt. There's one Mozart. But what Haydn did and the output is remarkable. I want you to hear something from what's called the early classical or Rococo period, his 26th symphony out of 104. I didn't take the 104th or the surprise or the military or the drum roll. They're famous. Here's the 26th. Very few people know it. Listen to the first 2 minutes and 4 seconds of the slow movement for an example of classical period beauty. Eyes closed, here goes. Oh, what band? Good question. I thought I would be sitting there, so let me tell you. It's number 2. Thank you. Like that? Relaxing, no? Is that the sense that you would have of it? Now, there is one composer who cracks me up. His name is Giacomo Rossini. Rossini wrote almost only operas. He made so much money, he is the opposite of what you know about the tragic artist. He made so much money and lived so long that he retired very early and didn't write any more music. He just knew how to write unbelievably beguiling melodies. When nations came before God for musical gifts, the Italians got melody. There is no question about it. The Germans got power, but the Italians got melody. That's why your Italian opera is just so dominant among opera lovers. Well, Rossini is in music. It is thoroughly untroubled. He is the man who wrote the William Tell Overture, which many of you know from The Lone Ranger. Da-da-dum, 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 and not exactly troubled, right? You don't slit your wrists after listening to the William Tell Overture. You may slit Silver's wrists, but who knows? Anyway, on Band 8 here, he wrote an opera called Il Turco in Italia. It means a Turk in Italy. Profound title. And I want you to hear a minute and 30 seconds. Go to, if you would, Band 8, 2 minutes and 30 seconds on it, where it's 2:30. Band 8, move, advance it to 2:30. Okay, so, no, keep it down. That's it. One of the great things about CDs is that you can do that. Go to the 2 minute and 30 second point and start playing. So this is in the middle of the overture to a Turk. I describe Rossini well, and they ate him up, and he would just spin out those melodies. Now I'm going to do something with you. The only piece tonight that I'm going to play, not in its entirety, but excerpts from all of it. Because we all, I guess if I had to isolate what I think, for me, this is thoroughly subjective, is the piece that I most appreciate in life. Of all music I've ever heard, and I've listened too long. Too much. It's the last piano sonata of Franz Schubert. Schubert also died terribly, terribly young. Where he would have gone, ironically, interests me even more than where Mozart would have ended up. Schubert lived from 1797 to 1828.
Could you make sure it's loud enough?
Yeah, absolutely. We'll make it louder, absolutely. Especially the piano, so you can all hear this. Let me just explain. Schubert knew he was dying when he wrote his last three sonatas. But this is the last of the three. This is the last, almost the last thing he ever wrote. It's his sonata in B-flat, and it's opus posthumus, meaning it was published after he died. I believe that he summarizes life and death. And what he does, what is so amazing is, he does it without the use of romantic media. In other words, he's not a romantic composer. He's classical. So he's constricted in what he can do. He can't just let it all out like Tchaikovsky. He can't have dissonance like modern composers. How do you express life and death within the confines of still making music? You can hear this as music, or you can hear it for what he meant it to be, music that tells about life and death. At the end, he dies, and I'll explain to you how that happens. It is remarkable. It is almost unique in music. The first, index one, the first minute is just the opening theme of the sonata, and it's basically walking through life. Listen to it carefully. Now listen to the rumble of death. And now he walks again. You got the idea. That was 1 minute's worth. Was there a lot said there? And do you notice the bittersweet melody? It's not a happy melody, but on the surface, it's just a da di da di da da di da di da da di da di da da. Right? That you really can hum. It's as simple as Jingle Bells. But it's haunting. It's haunting. It's not sweet. It's bittersweet. And that rumbling goes through the piece. The second movement is just deep. It's very, very slow, and I'd like you to go to from the beginning to the 2 minute 18 second mark in index two, the slow movement of his last sonata. Loud. Incredible what he does with a few notes, isn't it? That's what I mean by a composer speaking. It was more talking than it was music. And you feel, yeah, what's life about? That's really it's what he's doing, and that's what composers do constantly. In the third movement, he tries one more time to be happy, to gallop a little through life, and it works for a little bit. The third movement, for the first minute and 4 seconds. Something, huh? Just incredible. Now, okay. Now, he tries it, and it's all bittersweet. That's not happy, but it's lively. The fourth movement is one of the pearls of all Western music. What he does in it is he has, I am convinced here, a bell tolling for his life. And it's simply the note G. I know of no piece of music ever written before it, and very few after, that will just do that. It'll play, stop, give you one note, and continue playing. He wants to keep playing, but for whom the bell tolls? For us. The bell is a G. And what we're going to do is, this is the last movement of his last sonata. I just want you to hear it to the 1 minute point. Then I want to go to 3 minutes and 20 seconds and play the last 4 minutes. It's the only time I'm doing that much of a piece. What I want you to remember, the bell. And at the end of the piece, he does something with the bell that is incredible. The bell goes a half note lower and a half note lower. And we all know what it means. The last movement of his sonata, Opus Posthumus in B-flat, to 1 minute and then start at 3:20. There it is. See how he advances and you get carried away, right? And then, boom, it's just, that's why, isn't that what death is? You're all moving along. To represent it outside in, okay, here, the last 4 minutes. Ended on the bell. That's something? Well, no need to comment more on that. The pianist was Alfred Brendel. It's my second favorite performance of the piece. Wilhelm Kempf is the one I learned it with, and it's I think the greatest performance ever done of it. But that was great. It's a debated issue, and it's not pleasant, but which disease it was is not absolutely certain. Probably, what's that sexual disease that they used to have? Syphilis, yes. All right, get you up here after that. It's time to soar to the heavens in the romantic period. Let me play you. Oh, yes, go to... Let's Storm the Heavens in the Early Romantic Period, Beethoven's Ninth, the end of the last movement. Compare this attempt to storm the heavens with Handel's, and you'll see the difference between Baroque reaching to the heavens, and of course here it was with the words of Schiller's poem, Ode to Joy, which is a statement of world humanity, and so on. Here we go to Index 5. Let me see if that's correct. I'm sorry. He was deaf at this point. The last 2 minutes of Beethoven's Ninth. While, are you practically there? No.
Thank you.
I'd like you to hear the first minute and 30 seconds of his Fifth Symphony. Beethoven was an unparalleled genius. His genius, though he wrote some beautiful melodies, was not in melody. It was the ability to take a handful of notes and drive you crazy. What he did with it, no one in all of musical history could have done. You have in Beethoven's first movement, a movement of never equaled in sheer intense drive, based on a G, an E-flat, an F, and a D. That's it. Da-da-da-dum, da-da-da-dum. You figure, what can a guy do with it? Well, for the final installment, you got to buy the record. But I want you to hear what he does with this for the first minute and a half in the most famous chords probably ever written in music. Did you hear the ta-ta-ta-dum on the bass? Again? He'll repeat that. See, he'll repeat it, and then he'll go on, and that's where you got to get the PDQ Bach record on who he passes the theme to. If that piece didn't want to make you a conductor, you're unmovable. I mean, that you have to check your nerve endings. Well, that's early romantic. Let's go to later romantic now. An underrated composer, in my opinion, is Saint-Saëns. Saint-Saëns was a French romantic, not impressionist, thank God. And he wrote a symphony which is extremely well-known. It's that and Carnival of the Animals are about the only well-known things that he wrote, but he wrote major, beautiful other works. But I do want you to hear the beginning of the only symphony, major symphony that we know of, with a major portion for an organ. And it's called the Organ Symphony. It's actually his third symphony. It's in C minor, and his first two are very boring. The third is great, and even I love Saint-Saëns said that, but they were student works, the first two. This is the Saint-Saëns Symphony everyone knows. Listen to this opening 1 minute and 50 seconds from the Saint-Saëns Symphony. Now you're getting into the height of romantic music. how the third movement goes now. For the ultimate in what an orchestra could do in the Romantic period, I will play for you something that you probably don't need to have identified. The first minute and 54 seconds. This is the quintessence of Romantic music in orchestra. First band, to minute and 54, right? That was, of course, Richard Strauss's Also Sprach Zarathustra, Thus Spoke Zarathustra, the Zarathustra is the Zoroastrian prophet. That's a very far cry from Vivaldi, would you say? You understand now the traversal of musical eras? I'm now going to play for you a giant of the Romantic era as we move to the late 19th century. I consider this perhaps the most powerful Romantic movement written, the last movement of Tchaikovsky's Fourth Symphony in F minor. I want you to hear the first 3 minutes and 33 seconds. And I will tell you that this is the finest performance probably ever put on disc by Mravinsky and the Leningrad Philharmonic from almost 30 years ago. But his understanding of his fellow Russian and the propulsion will carry you away. If you heard the end of it, you would not be on your seat. The first 3 minutes, 33 seconds, it's on index 4. But, whet your appetite for Tchaikovsky's Fourth? While we're with Tchaikovsky, take out the other disc, please. I want you to just hear, wrote, and it was performed the month before he died, which would be, he died in November, and this would have been October. I don't have the date here. It's 1893, I thought. Is that about right? It's about right. Tchaikovsky had a terribly painful life. Tchaikovsky was in Russia, but that's not why it was painful. He was gay, and he was not happy about it because it wasn't a good time to be a homosexual, to say the least. And in fact, he almost went crazy because women would chase him because of his passionate music, and included one that he finally married just to get her off his back. Pain. And you will hear the pain which he himself wrote in one letter at the last movement of the Pathetique, his sixth symphony, his last symphony, is about life and death. I'd like you to hear from in index 6, go to 8 minutes. That was the other disc, right? And that thing, okay. And that's why it never gets quite the applause, the sixth, that the fifth, the fourth, the third's not so great, the second and the first get. But this is something. What he does with an orchestra to share his pain on and about life and death. 8 minutes. Imagine that after an unbelievable symphony. That's Schubertian in the way we spoke earlier. Last romantic example, just pure, undiluted beauty from Max Bruch. He wrote his first violin concerto in 1866, and Isaac Stern plays it to the hilt. The first 2 minutes and 26 seconds, index 6. Violin Concerto by Bruch. Not bad, huh? Is that exquisite? There's a piece I'll bet a lot of you have never even heard of Max Bruch. And there you go. This is just one of the gems of the violin literature. How could you put that on a miserable day and not say, things are not so miserable. They were miserable for Bruch, too. It's a real gift. All right, a few more minutes, folks. I appreciate your patience, but I think it's worth it. Go to the 20th century. 20th century has a lot of good music. Genius of the century. One of the greatest symphonists who ever lived, Gustav Mahler. Mahler was a Jew in Vienna. Freud was a Jew in Vienna. Herzl was a Jew in Vienna. There were a lot of big Jews in Vienna at that time. It's a very interesting crowd and an intense time. One of the people who actually heard Mahler conduct Mahler is Bruno Walter. And his recording of the Second Symphony is one of the gems of recorded literature. It's a huge work, well over an hour. I will give you just the beginning. I want you to hear the power, the intensity, and then just for a second, think back to Haydn. You'll see how far we've come. Listen to the beginning, the first 2 minutes and 18 seconds of Mahler's Second Symphony. How would you like to sit through an hour and a half of that? That's why when they play Mahler at concerts, they only play Mahler at concerts. There is no other piece on the program. The conductor usually comes out in underpants because anything else hinders one's ability to breathe and function. This is the quintessence of 20th century intensity. Enjoy music.
You have been listening to an introduction to classical music, a lecture given by Dennis Prager. This lecture was given on December the 18th, 1990, at the University of Judaism. If you would like a complete listing of Mr. Prager's other lectures and or information on Ultimate Issues, the quarterly journal that he writes and publishes, please write to us at 6020 Washington Boulevard, Culver City, California 90232. Or you may call us at area code 213-558-3958. The list of lectures is constantly incorporating new titles, and we look forward to any reactions you may have.